welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, lifelong youthfulness and usefulness. What's age got to do with it? Chair of the UAA Sociology Department, Dr. Ann Jackie, world-class snowboarder Casey Smith, distinguished Alaska legislator Arlis Sturgiluski, founder of the Total Health Clinic in Anchorage, Dr. Richard Newman, and Alaska Native leader Willie Hensley participated in the panel discussion on the topic organized by the UAA Human Services Department. Lifelong Youthfulness and Usefulness, What's Age Got to Do with It, was recorded at the UAA Bookstore on April 5th.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. I'm excited to discuss our topic, Lifelong Youthfulness and Usefulness, What's Age Got to Do with It. And as I was putting together the bios of the panelists that we have today, I'm just amazed at the wealth of experience and wisdom that we get to glean from tonight. And I'd like to thank all of you for coming. And the less I talk, the better, because the more you get to hear from them. So I'll go ahead and introduce our first panelist. With a PhD in sociology from Notre Dame, Anne has a long list of literature attached to her name to include her dissertation on elderly widows and their adult children. She's also noted for her work with local authors addressing socially and culturally sensitive topics. Specializing in family, aging, and social psychology, Anne has brought her passion for sociological advancement and enlightenment to colleges and universities for over 35 years to include Notre Dame, APU, and 30 years of service to the students here at UAA. Please welcome our first panelist, Dr. Anne Jackie.
Okay, when my son was 2 years old, we went to Older Persons Action Group's offices and somebody gave him a button. I'm not sure whether it was somebody that was in the audience or not, I think maybe, but it was a round button, pretty big, and it said, enjoy your age. And I pinned it on his coat, and every time he needed a new coat, I kept pinning it on his coat, and he was very proud to have something that came from Older Persons Action Group that said, enjoy your age. And so I was thinking about that when I was thinking about the title of this presentation and what I could say, and I often think about that when I teach the courses in the gerontology minor program that I teach. When I was 23, I taught my first course. It was a course in sociology of the family, and I taught full-time at a small Roman Catholic college in Kansas. And it took me as much time to prepare for every single class as it takes any student here to write a term paper. I didn't have background knowledge. I certainly had some coursework behind me and a master's degree, but I had to read several books for pretty much every course that I taught. I enjoyed my age, but I didn't do much else than read books and prepare for lectures several times a day, every single day. 25 years later, I walked across campus. And as I walked across this campus, I saw people, students, who I had known when they were little babies. I had students that had been in my Sunday school class, and I had students that had played with my children, and I had students that I had taken care of as little children in my home, but they were college students. And I began to worry about that, and I'm enjoying my age, but I began to worry that maybe if it was 25 years later, and I had been teaching not really continuously all that time, but I certainly had been doing the same kind of thing for 25 years, maybe I was too old to do that, until I thought about my favorite professors. And my favorite professors were the parents of my friends. I went to a small college in Iowa, and we lived, the children of the faculty went to college with me, and the professors were very generous about letting us come into their home and serving us dinner. The really best professors, the professors that I can still remember the things they said, were the parents of my friends, which meant that they were somewhere in their 50s. So I continue to enjoy my age and think about some of the advantages that being a mature professor has. Not that I wasn't an extraordinary happy to be doing it professor when I was 23, but as a mature professor, I do not spend 8 hours or 2 weeks preparing for every single class that I teach. I certainly spend a lot of time and I think about it, but I have a background of knowledge. And anybody that asks me a question, I can either say, I don't know the answer to that, or we don't know the answer to that. I have a better sense of whether the field, somebody has ever studied that before. And I almost always have enough background information that I can direct, that I have the wisdom to be able to provide some insight. And more than that, one of the things that comes with maturity is not just giving the answer, which I did when I was 23, but helping people find out the answer. I rarely give any direction now. That's one of the things that comes with maturity. What's age got to do with that? I'm seeing Professor Fast in the audience, and she once told me about an anthropologist study of age grade among the Tanana Athabascan. She said that if you count on your fingers and your toes, you get to 20. And if you think about every 20 years, you increase in wisdom. But starting with 20, you really don't have much capacity to think, according to the age grade system of the Tanana across the Athabascans. By 40, your mind is working, and by 60, you're able to become wise. It takes a little while to accumulate the knowledge and experience and wisdom and do it through observation in order to become wise. You certainly have a brain, but your mind seems to not start to work according to this system, and I think there's lots of evidence in social gerontology to support this, until you're about 40. And then it takes even longer until you're starting to become wise. At 23, I was just developing the capacity to think. I certainly could teach. I did my job. I got good course reviews. But now approaching 60, my mind is working. And maybe it'll be possible for me to become wise, too. So what's age got to do with it? It does take longer for me to recall names of my students. I have to spend more effort learning the names of my students, and I do, because I think it's important, but it's now halfway through the semester, and there are some students that it takes, they have to go through several sequences of names in order for me to remember who they are, and I eventually can, but it takes some effort on my part. That's true for everybody. That problem with word fighting starts about 20. If you were to measure it, it just takes a little bit longer for you to remember the name of an object or a person. By the time you're 30, you start to notice that it takes a little bit longer. And by the time you're 60, other people notice that it's taking longer and longer to remember names and remember names of objects. It doesn't mean that you're becoming stupider. It means that you have so much information in your head that you have to sort through what's there in order to find the best name for an object or for a person. When you're 20, you know a few people and a few names of objects. People over 70 know more words and they have larger vocabularies. It's harder to hear in noisy contexts. It's harder to read print if there's a fancy background behind a poster. If I tell my students that you put the fancy stuff around the edge of the words, not in the middle, if you want everybody to be able to read that. And it may take more time to solve a silly problem or a game that somebody's given you, but you will spend your time, as you start to become wise, figuring out what the problem is so that the important problems can be solved. The other thing that I find myself doing, and I know from studies about knowledge and aging, is that as we mature, we're more likely to omit answers that we don't know. They call it errors of omission. And that's why on every multiple choice test, this upsets some of my students, I require that they omit one or two questions, depending upon how many questions are on the test. Because one of the things that comes along with maturity is knowing what you don't know. If you're 20, you're happy to just guess. And on most multiple choice tests, that's pretty good strategy. But as you accumulate life wisdom, you know that it's better to just say you don't know than it is to venture a guess or a possible answer. A couple other things about maturity. One of the things that my students always worry about is that older people must be very, very lonely. They're quite certain that older people are lonely. But studies of people that are living, who are over 70, that are actually living in the community, find that most people say they're rarely lonely or not lonely at all, even though they may have lost many people. You develop the capacity to set that aside. And one of the things that comes with maturity is the ability to think, to hold two emotions in your heart at the same time. We call it poignancy, but you can hold grief and joy at the same time, and which is very, very hard to do before about age 60. It's one of the things that you get better and better at, holding two genuine, strong emotions at the same time. And the other thing that goes along with that is the tendency to choose happy emotions, to act on happy emotions or positive emotions rather than sad or angry emotions. You develop better coping mechanisms.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm in between 20 and 40 right now, almost exactly, so I'm kind of at that mid brain not working, brain starting to work. I appreciate that perspective because I understand now. Okay, our next panelist with a master's in geological engineering from Michigan Tech. He's traveled the world bringing companies like Conoco, Amoco, and BP to a higher level with his inspiring outlook and drive for success, leadership, and innovation. For over 30 years, Casey has worked to bring out the best in these companies, maximizing and realizing their potential for growth, development, and positive global impact, including a scholarly partnership with major universities worldwide to influence the most informed perspective on global business policies. As one of his many outdoor passions, Casey has taken snowboarding to the national level, claiming gold, silver, and bronze medals in Ski Magazine's NASTAR Championship. Certified nationally through Professional Ski Instructors of America and the American Association of Snowboard Instructors, Casey instructs at Hilltop Ski Area. Casey is currently working on three manuscripts, including his family's international life and global influence, novel leadership perspectives, and how to properly interact with 911 operators, which some skills I could have used a time or two. Please welcome Casey Smith.
Thank you, JP. Very pleased to be here tonight. I'd like to tell a little bit about how I came to be and interested in lifelong youthfulness and usefulness. As I was growing up, I was always asking, well, why not? Let me try. Why can't I? And I would hear things from parents that would be, well, that's kind of risky. We don't use that toy that way. Watch out. Be careful. You know, don't. That seems to be somewhat endemic as to we drag the intuitively open and innovativeness and just awe-inspiring in nature of our children. We just drum it right out of them. And then they become adults, and pretty soon, you know, we have to struggle in our institutions, whether they be academic, whether they be political, non-political, private, to get them to be innovative, to come up with new ideas. And we call think tanks and all sorts of, you know, different opportunities and techniques to, well, get out of that box. And then I hear things like, oh, you know, I had a knee thing and I can't participate in that. Or, you know, that's well beyond my reach. Or it's too much risk. And, you know, we have these companies called insurance companies that just love to ply on our risk, you know. You're going to die tomorrow. You better buy this insurance. Well, you know, the chances of having, you know, Exacare is about like getting mauled by a grizzly bear and a polar bear on the same day and da-da-da-da-da. And I'll tell you a little story. I was snowboarding, and last year, a rather humbling experience was I was taking a picture of my niece, and a 75-year-old woman that had both knees replaced ran into me. And she was a extremely good skier and still out on the hill. So one of the things that set me off as a young person was mentorship. Each of us as adults have the ability in what we say and what we do and how we act. We have the tremendous power to influence the youth that we come in contact with. And I don't mean the utterance from our mouth. I mean how we communicate. I mean it's that smile. I mean it's getting down to their level for the youth. I mean it's getting them excited about the political process, about a sport, about a hobby you do, about not being complacent. Oh, somebody else will take care of it. I'll drop them off at the, you know, ski hill, and maybe an instructor will take care of them, or I'll drop them off at this activity and somebody else will take care of them. I mean, getting involved, especially for the generation of lifelong usefulness. Do you know how much skill and experience just in this gathering there is? Tremendous amount. It's just a matter of utilizing it, taking the risk. We're not all perfect, but taking the risk. And what got me excited was I want to go out of this world exhausted. I grew up and I was allowed to take those chances by my parents. I grew up in a farm in southern Ohio, and, you know, at 5 years old, okay, big farm, go out there, take a tent, and, you know, we'll see you in the morning. You know, via Candias. And, okay, I had a dog with me, but, you know, so I had those abilities. And, you know, I'm sure my parents were kind of biting their fingernails and that sort of thing. Bad things can happen. But we learn from good and bad experiences. In fact, pedagogy, not to be confused with andragogy. Andragogy is the adult science of learning. Pedagogy, you know, says we tend to learn a lot better through negative rather than positive. I had the ability to go to a university called Michigan Tech, and every quarter, that's kind of dating myself because not many schools have quarters anymore. All through PhD, we had to take a physical education course because they were all about the balance of mind and body. Sharp mind, sharp body. And I developed this with my students. You know, I was so poor, I got into hockey, I couldn't afford a full uniform, so a rather indelicate statement was I split a uniform with one of my friends, and he had part of the uniform, I had the other part, and it had a rather indelicate bouquet. But we always, in the university, you were always actually encouraged that if you were in a fit shape, your mental attitude was in a fit shape. You were at your peak attitude of learning, of being able to assimilate. So I always push myself. It might be, how can I get from this classroom to that classroom a little bit faster? Well, with, you know, some of the winds that come through here, we had the same winds, you know. It's a matter of, okay, I can skip holding on to that rope if I just slide a long ways on my rear end, and I can catch that other rope to the building and hopefully not go into the lake, Lake Superior, that is. So I'd been skiing all my life, ski patrol with my beautiful bride, who unfortunately they didn't realize because we were on opposite ships. We kind of looked alike. They thought we were brother and sister until the end of the year. I gave her a big smooch, and they thought that was quite hideous. And then I had to show the wedding ring. But I saw some people actually on this snowboard, and I thought, wow, I used one of those in 1966. It was called a snurfer of them. Here's something that I really want to show. This is a gentleman from my university that I just happened to run into last year. He made the nationals, and he's 84 years old. And he just skied down just to kind of watch and say, hey, you know, I didn't know you were out here. So the idea is, you know, I got hit by a person that had two knee replacements, that's 75 years old, that's still skiing. The instructor that actually certified me for my national ski instructor board has had many injuries and replacements. If you really want to do it, you can do it. It's a matter of having your mental and physical ability together. And I was talking with a woman here in the front row, you know, 92 years old, and, you know, people are having a hard time keeping up with her. And, you know, I chatted with my mom today. She's going on 90 here in a couple days, and I just had to buy her a new computer because the old one was too slow, and she wants to know why I don't look at her posts on my, you know, Facebook, and why don't I respond to her IMs? My life is over. My mom's on Facebook. You know? So, but the point being is everybody can find something that challenges them beyond what they thought they could do. It can be losing weight. It can be riding a bike. It can be participating in a walk. But it's something you never thought you could do, because when you look at the individuals out there, there's something called you don't know what you don't know. You have to explore that. That's where all this expertise, especially with the demographics, and you have such a gift to give. And for me, if I don't challenge myself each and every day, physically and mentally, to improve and to impact someone, especially the next generations coming up, especially a certain person in this audience, a young lad, we are doing nothing but being complacent about the next generation and just sitting here hoping for the best.
Thank you, Casey. I know when I told my mom to drag something onto her desktop, she said, how do I get it off the computer? Well, our next panelist, I relied heavily on the internet for these bios because I am not quite 40 yet. So our next panelist has her own Wikipedia page, a University of Washington graduate, with a BA in economics and an honorary doctor of law degree from UAA. Arliss has a long-standing history of business and politics in Alaska. She served Anchorage in the Alaska Senate over a 20-year span and was a Republican nominee for governor twice between Senate terms. Arliss has served on the Advisory Council for the University of Alaska, School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, as well as numerous other statewide boards and commissions, past and present. The notable Arliss Sturgalewski papers are a treasured piece of UAA's consortium library collection and reflect many of the roles she's played in Alaskan history and the hard work and diligence it took to fill those roles. Please welcome Athena Award winner and Alaska Women's Hall of Fame member Arliss Sturgalewski.
Well, I'm 84. Can I be a world-class snowboarder?
We can start Monday.
I may be otherwise engaged. but that is quite an age. But I love the name of this panel. Life, youthfulness, usefulness. What's age got to do with it? Well, certainly covers a lifetime. In my case, there's 84 years. A lot of happenings, a lot of impressions. And finally, the person you become. But you're changing all those years. So much has happened to be what you are at a certain age. I kind of like the idea of age, though. I'm having a good time. I was born what we might judge today as extremely poor. A small farm in Northwest Washington, the earlier years took place during the Great Depression, and it was a corker of the early 30s. There were so many things that are so basic today that we didn't have, and you look back and you think, well, gosh, how could you survive? There was no TV, there were no computers. There was an outdoor outhouse that we had for years. We finally got a telephone, but it was a party line, so you knew if you were Snoopy, and there were a lot of people from the little cliques on the line that were Snoopy, you knew what was going on. But we raised our own vegetables, we canned them, we didn't have ice, we didn't have refrigerators. We raised our chickens and hogs. We had lots of milk. So I've got good bones today. I haven't had a broken bone yet. Our diet was pretty good. But also things were happening that formed a lifetime. We had a dear friend. I have a twin brother. This dear friend had a brother. His brother, at a very young age, happened to be gay. And he took his own life. People didn't talk about that much, but there were whispers that went on. And that formed, I'm a very strong supporter, have been throughout my lifetime, for equal rights. And that comes from losing Leslie's brother so many, many years ago. I think that the difference is I didn't see a black person until I was in my teens. I remember I was involved in 4-H, and we took a train trip to Chicago, the biggest thing that had happened to me, and oh, the wondrous sights that I saw. But I couldn't imagine that from contrast to this small little community I have. I graduated from high school, as they say, early, and that they used to call it skipping. I don't know what they call now when you skip a grade or two. And I was a lonely kid in a lot of ways. Mom had died when I was just 10, but she'd been a teacher. She was a graduate for a two-year school. It was called in those days a normal school. When she married, she was not allowed to be a teacher. She was a gifted woman. She was in demand at our school. She gave readings for those of you that have a few years, kind of part of like the Chautauqua circuit, which meant for rural communities. There was a group of people who did readings and put on entertainment. So I saw that she built things into her life that she could do, even though she couldn't be a teacher, that she loved to be. Anyhow, about that time, I approached my dad. He ran a small logging company, and family still involved in an outgrowth of that. Now, I told him about my desire to go to college because my mother had, and my had certain teachers who encouraged me. And I can still remember this so clearly. He said, "I'll help your brothers, but not you, because girls just get married, and it's a waste of education." And that, I think, seared my soul. But that was not an uncommon thing. But I've struggled to forgive Dad for that. Well, that made me determined to get an education. And I worked my way through the U of Washington. It was hard, but I learned about being a hasher in a construction camp up on the Skagit River. I was a bookkeeper. I pumped gas at the local gas station. And I got through college, and I only owed, I'd borrowed from a brother, $500. But by God, I got my education at the University of Washington. But anyhow, my dad was real proud of me then, but he never said it to my face, but he talked to all the other people around that he associated with. And it was a lesson to me that you can go ahead and you can do things on your own, but I think we're a product of whatever our experiences were. Went to work for a firm in Seattle, the cosmetic firm. They were sold to an East Coast firm, and I answered an ad in the paper. I had family here in Alaska. And so we came up the highway with these people. I'd answered an ad. They went homesteading, I think, down in the Kenai Peninsula, and I can still remember the generators at night when we stopped to get gas, sometimes camping out, somebody staying in one of the lodges, but always the generators running to provide electricity. And I met a wonderful man up here. He was a graduate of UAF in engineering. He was killed in an air crash in western Alaska in 1968. I have a wonderful son, daughter-in-law, grandkids. I never went home. I was going to be here for 2 weeks, but got hooked. Did a lot with borough government. I served on the charter commission that unified our local government. Then on to the state senate for some 14 years. Oh, and the lessons I learned. I can still remember former state senator Halford talking about Arliss, and often to my face. I was Miss Goody Two-Shoes to him because I didn't know how to play the games. And I don't think I ever learned, but there were always people willing to teach. But I was a very poor student on that. But a lot of good things in those kinds of things. I did make a decision not to run for re-election to the state senate in 1992, but certainly didn't retire from public life. And that I've been so lucky because although as a single woman, I did not remarry after losing my wonderful husband, there are things I care about real passionately, and I can still work on those. I can still contribute, but when you contribute, you also get things back. And one thing I'm interested in is trying to have people reach outside of their own lives and bring others in. I mean, if every nonprofit looked out and saw that five other nonprofits were doing the same thing with kids that were in trouble or teens or whatever and work together, how much more impact we would have. Everybody carrying out their mission, but opening the door for cooperation. I think that I've had some wonderful experiences in Alaska, and there's at least one fellow here in the audience who's part of a group. I think there are 15 or 16 of us, and we've traveled to all different places in Alaska. We call ourselves the Road Runners. We don't run on roads, but we've sure had some wonderful trips. We've been to Nome, to the Stikine River to see bears and salmon. Some of us have gone out to Unalaska on a ferry, and they're just been able to see Alaska, and I've loved rural Alaska, and we need so much to reach out to rural Alaska. I just recently, three of us went on up to Sea Point Hope. I'd never done that. We stopped in Kotzebue and attended. There was a conference there, and I found there are very, very few people from the urban areas, and I thought how much they would have benefited if they had been on hand, and vice versa. I think we need to really look at that. I've been fortunate enough to be on a number of national state boards, the Challenger Board of Direction, the Directors, chance for kids to participate in space, the Iditarod Trail, the Imaginarium, kids voting, the Mountain View Task Force, all kinds of things that caught my attention and interest that are out there. But anyhow, and still serving. In order to keep the clutter out of my life, one thing with retirement, I'm not very successful with that, but I try. I'm a little gimpy, but thanks heavens, my mind works. So I have an office. I'm still issue-oriented. Tony Knowles and I, as perhaps you may know, co-chaired the Prop 5 issue, and it broke my heart, and I'm recovering slowly, I think, on the Equal Rights Ordinance. As I say, that comes out of a real long history, and it's an issue not resolved, and it'll take a course. I hope we've made some steps that might bring that closer. I think it was a well-run campaign, but you know, you don't win all the battles, but that doesn't mean you don't fight them, for gosh sakes. Yeah. Anyhow, I'm grateful for my acceptance in the Alaska community. Pleased I've been a participant and not just a spectator all these years. I feel like I've lived in this place. I was very active with the rewrite of the municipal code. That sucker was 160 pages, and then Representative Parker and I worked together with the regional development organizations, with the permanent fund, with inflation proofing, things I can point to that I'm proud of. But mostly, I love this place. I love the involvement. I love the university, and I don't mean just UAA, but it can open the lives for people. I like the way the seniors are treated and the opportunities that they have. And I guess I'm one of those that feels like I'm an extraordinarily lucky Alaskan. And I think I will continue to gimp around a bit with my age-related issues, but hoping that my mind stays sharp so that I can be involved in this wonderful place that I call home. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to a panel discussion on lifelong youthfulness and usefulness, recorded at the UAA Bookstore on April 5th. First to speak was UAA Sociology Department Chair Dr. Ann Jackie, followed by world-class snowboarder Casey Smith, and then distinguished Alaska State Legislator Arlis Sturjaluski.
All right. While addressing the chiropractic needs of Anchorage since 1979, Dr. Newman is the founder of Total Health Clinic and continues to serve four generations of patients today. During his career, he spent his passion volunteering in rural Mexico, improving care for track and field athletes, including some of Mexico's national champions, and avidly researching to keep himself and his patients on the cutting edge of health and wellness. Please welcome Dr. Richard Newman.
Things. So I don't know if I was listening to Casey. I didn't know if he was going to be undermining my type of profession or contributing to it. So it could be either way. And I'm going to deal with here is something that should be on front page news every day, in my opinion. And it has to do with the fact that that a consequence of the medical outlook that we have, what I call a limited medical outlook, is bankruptcy, and that we have a medical budget that is actually greater than the national budget of most of the countries of the world, and it's, as you know, unsustainable. So what I'm going to talk about is a way of looking at that a little differently that you may not have heard before. How many people here are chiropractic patients, by the way, have experience with chiropractic? How many people think they know what chiropractic is? So we're going to talk about that chiropractic is a vitalistic system, which means that it has a relationship to an overall way of looking at life, way of looking at reality. And I'm going to invoke a spiritual concept here. How many people here don't believe in God? As Mr. T used to say, I'm not. That's your problem, but I'm just kidding. No, I probably don't believe in this, and in the God that you don't believe in either. But I'm gonna bring up a spiritual notion in here, in our understanding of this, and we're gonna talk about how holistic health and natural health enables us to attain a state of youth and a state of really what could be looked at as eternal life on a physical, energetic level. And we're going to talk about how we become. Our model in healthcare is we look at the little kids, we look at the five-year-olds, the healthy ones, the six-year-olds, the seven-year-olds, the enthusiastic ones, and we say, we want to be like that. We can be like that. And that is the objective, and that has to do with attaining the state of energy, the state of function that we are all endowed with, and that this drive, this motive to become healthy, to become like we were when we were that age, is a given. Not everybody, I think, we understand, because has the gifts that Casey has the gifts that Arliss has, that has the incredible bestowal to achieve what they've accomplished. But we, all of us, do have a capacity to attain a level of health that we'd never thought possible. And so if you look on the facts page of your leaflet, there is a group of actually medically oriented people who started a health maintenance organization in the Midwest who got it. What I mean to say is, when they say they got it, is that they understood that although modern medicine is incredible, miraculous, I don't want anybody here to take me as saying that there's any problems with modern medicine. I am incredulous, as we all are, at what modern medicine is able to accomplish. But what I do want to offer is that it's not as incredible, it's not as miraculous as the miracle of the human body functioning as it was intended to do. So this group of actually doctors put together a health maintenance organization in which the primary care physicians were holistic chiropractors, that is, chiropractors that were conversant with acupuncture, conversant with herbal medicine, conversant with massage therapy. And they had thousands and thousands of people under their program as their inscribers. And we have a study. I have a sheet, a part of your sheet, which is called the facts, ma'am. And those facts, we have the outcomes of two phases of study. And the ultimate bottom line, look at the bottom line in front of you in medical outcomes, comparing a track of patients who went with what they call an integrated model. In other words, you went and you got chiropractic care as your major, as your primary portal. You got whatever you needed according to that chiropractic assessment. And you got medical care as needed. If you needed surgery, you got surgery. If you need drugs, you got drugs. Then we had a model which was simply straight conventional medicine. And the outcome after 2 years, just briefly, I'll read for you, is there was a 43% reduction in hospital admissions. There was a 58% reduction in hospital days spent in the hospital. There was a 51% reduction in pharmaceutical costs, 43% reduction in outpatient surgeries and procedures. You can crunch the numbers. I don't have to tell you, if you extend this over to the society as a whole, what we're talking about, just on that level. Not counting the agony, not counting the rehabilitation, not counting the complications with the family and the work and all that. 4 years later, they did an update and everything improved. Everything went from the, for example, you can see it yourself, the reduction in pharmaceutical costs was 85%. Actually, I'm in touch with these people, this outfit in the Midwest, and they're actually, the figures were even more impressive, but they toned it down. Because actually the result in overall costs was, the unit of medical expenditures was 88% reduced. So actually for the purpose of the publication. Now, even that was too much for the publication. They wanted to get that into New England Journal of Medicine. They wanted to get this, where are these studies? Where's the proof of what we're doing? Well, they wanted to go to the top. These were medical doctors, and they submitted to the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Sarnat, who was the originator of the study, kept the rejection letter. He's got it framed up on his wall, right? The rejection letter says, your studies are impressive. We can find no problem with them. At the present time, the subject is too controversial to be published. He said, so much for science. So let's talk about the unity of science and religion. Okay, let's talk about what's needed is that there needs to be a healing. So what I'm promoting today and what you've got in your material is the hope that not that medicine is deficient, not that medicine is errant, it is merely incomplete. And we're talking about proposing a completion to medicine, which means to really put it on a scientific basis, because what a true science needs is a theory. A true science needs a theory. Without a theory, you don't have an explanation. You can't take a diverse series of phenomena, i.e. the welter of symptoms, the welter of complaints, the welter of pains, and you can't make sense of that without a theory. And in order to have a theory, like any science, like physics, like biology, like chemistry, you have to have something which tells you what's going on underneath. What's going on underneath these symptoms and complaints? Person's got a head pain, what is the cause of the head pain? It's not the deficiency of aspirin. It's not the deficiency of they got a back pain. It's not a deficiency of ibuprofen. There is something dysfunctioning in that person's system. And so what your sheet that everybody has, we call it the inverted iceberg theory. I call it the heart line or the inverted iceberg theory. When you look at it, hold it up so everybody so you can see it. Let me know you're looking at it. I tried to get igloo in there, but I couldn't get igloo. So I was satisfied with iceberg. The inverted iceberg theory says that what the symptoms or the complaints that someone presents is merely the tip of the iceberg. And so what the objective of a causal practitioner is what is in the base of the iceberg? What is going on at the base underlying the tip of the iceberg that is producing that popping through of a symptom? What is the greatest mystery in medicine? What is the greatest challenge in history in medicine? Is that a person can be carrying a lethal terminal illness, and they don't know it. They don't know it, the physician doesn't know it, nobody knows it until they're in the emergency room or intensive care. What is the reason for this? How can this possibly be? Because 80% of the health problems, as we say, are not medical. They are the contributing causes which eventually surface as a medical problem. Once it becomes a medical problem, pathologies, yeah, you might need medicine. You gotta put the fire out. You might need to have anything. But somebody ought to be interested in how that came about for quickest results and for complete results and to make sure the problem doesn't return. So the consequences of what we call fleeing from cause or repudiating cause is what we're looking at in terms of the hospitalizations, the medical use, and so on. So the cause we identify has to do with non-medical problems. They have to do with, in the front of your page, what we call theory. So you got the facts page. By the way, there's a couple more studies on that facts page. Studies of Medicare patients, studies of amazing reductions. Just amazing reductions of utilization and expense and so forth. The cause, but in terms of the theory page, the cause of the entry of disease into the human organism is a disequilibrium of forces regulating the function of the body. This is a spiritual scripture, by the way. This comes from scripture of the Baha'i faith, which happens to be my religion. And there's a lot of teachings, like all faiths, is teachings about healing. Why is there teaching about healing in all religions? Why do all religions, Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, talk about healing and disease? Because healing is an inseparable and functions inseparable quality of life. What's the difference between a heap of protoplasm, of dead cells and material and carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and something that's functioning and adapting and vital? It's the expression, it's the life, it's the life force. Now, you can call that soul, you can call that spirit. These quotes happen to have use the word soul. If you don't like that, I totally understand that. We can substitute it with spirit. The cause of the entry of disease into the human organism is the disequilibrium in the forces regulating body functioning. Because those regulation of forces is merely an expression of a transcendent power that exists before there was a body. How does one cell, how does the germ cell, you guys, I don't have to tell you about that, how does the germ cell, which is created from the union of the man and the woman, become from one cell a living functioning organism of quadrillions of cells in 9 months? How does that happen? Does anybody know? No, that's a big one. That is probably even bigger mystery in medicine. Whatever that power is, whatever that coordinating function, predates the nervous system, predates the circulatory system, predates the that is an operating system that is the principle of life. And when a person is born, when a person emits from the mother, is that power still there? Is that capacity still there? Of course it is. What's it doing? Did it disappear? No, it's still there. But the interferences in the body forces which function represent an interference in that expression. So we say that the illness is an interference to the expression of the soul's inherent radiance and power. It's an interference to the expression of the soul's inherent radiance. So when we're sick, when we have that, and the relevance to this discussion, in case you're wondering, is that power is indestructible. And the sickest person in this room, the sickest person in this city, has as much healing power, has as much capacity in their spirit as the most healthy. It's just interfered. It's just not being expressed. The objective, then the practical difference, where we diverge from medicine, and we're all committed to the well-being of patients, the commitment to patients, the love of what we do, and the service to patients, but our divergence is that the holistic practitioner, the holistic chiropractor, is going to see how can we release that healing power again? What has happened to obscure that healing ability? It's there. It's there. It's just not being expressed. And we look at the subtle imbalances which comprise all the natural health professions. And that you have on your chart, it's a study, so I apologize. I don't really want to make anybody work that hard. But that's a chart, and in you'll notice, if you can read it, the different natural therapies are defined by the different kinds of forces. What are the forces that make anything work in the universe or in the body? What are the forces? We have mechanical forces, we have electrical forces, we have chemical forces, we have mental forces. And all these forces combine to make a functioning person. We know, and the theory says that if there's an interference, if there's a problem in the human body, the level of, there's some imbalance in some of those forces. It's got to be. If it's not one place, if it's another. And those force relationships determine the natural therapy. Musculoskeletal therapy, nutrition, biochemistry, chiropractic, acupuncture, electromagnetic therapies, emotional, psychological therapies. So this is what we mean by a theory. This is a contribution to the theory of medicine, and we need an openness. We need a spiritual attitude to heal the health professions, to bring the health professions together so that the country and the individuals in the country will be achieving their maximum potential.
Wow, thank you, Dr. Newman. Well, our next panelist, I happen to be a minor in Alaska Native Studies student, so I feel like I could give an impromptu speech in APA format on Mr. Hensley. But just to keep my facts straight, I consulted Google and willyhensley.com. Wikipedia hasn't caught the buzz yet, sorry. Willie's a lifelong Alaskan, which in UPAC years is about 50,000, I think. He's tirelessly dedicated to the restoration and the advancement of Alaska Natives and the betterment of all Alaska through education and public policy. With a bachelor's in political science from George Washington University, Mr. Hensley has served as an Alaska State House Representative, Senator and Chairman of several state committees, Founder, Director, and President of NANA Corporation, Director, President, and Co-Chairman of Alaska Federation of Natives, and many other board positions and commissions that have shaped Alaska for decades. His passion for justice and a rapidly changing land fueled the campaign that led to the development and passing of Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act and forever changed the way the world addresses indigenous nations. Please welcome Mr. Willie Hensley.
Katirugut uva mani university me ani ronga 1941 me kekek tagru me tagir me ngurunga asin inyuni aktogut no tampangani ikatura me I am just saying that my name is Raruk that I'm happy that we're meeting here at the university tonight. I was born in 1941 along the shore of Kotzebue Sound and that our family made our living along the mouth of the Noatak River at a little place called Ikatuk, a very small creek there that had a lot of fish in it. It was so small you could leap across it, really. But it was loaded with whitefish. I wasn't quite sure why I accepted this invitation, since I don't feel like an elder yet, and I'm not sure if I ever will, actually. I do sense a little slowing down of the systems, however. I won't go into any detail. To me, an elder status requires a substantial character and knowledge and wisdom, and I think on all those fronts I'm deficient. I do say, though, that I was fortunate in that I was raised by elders. My mother's uncle and his wife adopted me and my sister. And they were born before the turn of the century. So I had the good fortune of being raised by people who came from what I call the old world. Before even Kotzebue was a community per se, it had been a very famous location, but not a real large community. In any case, Kotzebue was a place where there was a tremendous amount of fish and game, lots of rabbits and ptarmigans, and we had a lot of driftwood because three rivers emptied into Kotzebue Sound, the Noatak, Kobuk, and the Selwick, and we had easy access to seals and beluga and some walrus if you went out far enough. So it was an excellent place to subsist. In our world, the elders, like many indigenous cultures, the elders had a lot of respect. And they had respect because generally they had tremendous experiences to relate. They had a tremendous amount of knowledge of the flora and the fauna and the natural world and about our own people. They also had wisdom. That's something that I did not distinguish early on in my life, the difference between knowledge and wisdom. I mean, there are plenty of people that have plenty of knowledge but are like bouncing from wall to wall, because they haven't had the depth of understanding of the human spirit and the complexities of human life. The elders knew a great deal about the animal life, which were so important to us. They knew about the caring of the meat and the fish, and the preservation, and the women in particular, they were totally critical to our survival, and their life was very hard. I mean, life always was hard for everybody, but women in particular. I think I calculated one time that that in a normal lifespan, with a normal number of children, a woman may have had to construct 400 pairs of mukluks by hand. And she had to chew those skins, you know, to make that bottom out of the seal skin. Anyway, it was a hard life, and there was no room for sloth in our world. The young men were taught by the elderly, and unfortunately for us, the school systems and the education system that we inherited, and they in fact were one and the same in the early days of our lives, at the turn of the century, Sheldon Jackson essentially turned the children over to the missionaries. And of course they were bound and determined to literally destroy almost every aspect of our traditional world, which was very, very sad. But our grandparents were very, very interested in education. I mean, to the point where they virtually allowed the destruction of the identity and culture, because they knew how hard our life was in those old days. And I think they thought that the Western world would be an easier life. And I thought about this, especially when I found two dozen letters that were being sold on the internet of letters written by people from Kotzebue in 1915 to 1918. And lo and behold, I didn't even know that my grandfather could write. I mean, I had hardly an image of him. But here he was, already in his 20s, and he had a pen pal in Elkhart, Indiana, to whom he was writing, to whom he had never met, as an exercise, you know, in English, a difficult language. But to me, it showed that they were curious about the rest of the world. I saw the letters asking about the World War that had been going on. At that time, they were trying to learn a new technology. They were learning how to become herders as opposed to hunters, with the introduction of reindeer. And they had Lapps who came from Scandinavia to help teach them the new technology of husbandry. Anyway, the young men were generally taught at the kharigi, or kazgi, some people say. Kati means to meet. A kharigi is a place where the people met, and generally, normally referred to as a men's house, but it was a very, very important school that even the missionaries decided was sinful, and worked against the kari as well as, of course, against music and dance. The music and dance was declared to be sinful, and consequently, people quit for a long time in our part of the world. It didn't wipe it out. But nevertheless, we were under substantial repression of some of the key elements of our society, including our language, of course, that went on into my day, the repression of the language and of the culture. And so, of course, the government was firmly in control. They decided whether we went to school or not, to high school, and where. Many ended up in the Indian boarding schools in Chilaco, Oklahoma, Chemung, Oregon, or Sitka, and Wrangell Institute. And, of course, those schools, unfortunately, were designed to sort of kill the Indian but save the man sort of idea, and which was, a policy of the federal government down south that we inherited up here, unfortunately. And so so for us today, those of us who are presumed elders were operating with handicaps. I was away from home for 4 years as a teenager, so coming home only once for about a month. Many other children were gone for 9 months out of the year, most of their lives from 8 or 9 years old on. And so that can't help but have a substantial effect on your ability to communicate, you know, with your elders, with your uncles, with your aunts, all these people who normally help you learn about life and learn the skills. And so that sort of is our history. So in a sense, I'm a kind of a lifelong learner myself because unlike some of you, I have to be bicultural. I'm having to relearn our own language and elements of our culture, even at my age, you know. Anyway, after a lifetime in business and politics, I really didn't learn anything, as someone suggested, till I was about 40, when I first began to understand sort of the nature of the sort of the complexity of a human life and what shapes a personality and behavior, and came to realize that. With a lot of change in technology and institutions, what we call modernization, I mean, the essential truths, I think, we discovered were the things that kept us going for thousands of years, and these were our values. And some of you may have seen them. We isolated those as being the essence of our traditional Inupiaq world, and I'll just mention some of them. well, the knowledge of our language, it keeps us connected to our world. Sharing, respect for others, respect for the elders, loving your children, cooperation, hard work, you know, knowledge of your family tree, avoidance of family conflict, respect for nature, spirituality, humor, knowing your family role, hunter success, and we translate that to being a productive person today. Domestic skills, in our old world, it was critical. In today's world, it's important, but I do a lot of that myself now. Humility, in our world, no matter how successful you are, your good qualities are talked about by other people. Not yourself. And the other, responsibility to tribe, and in the larger context to us, that means a responsibility to our fellow man. Thank you very much.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Chair of the UAA Sociology Department, Dr. Ann Jackie, world-class snowboarder Casey Smith, distinguished Alaska State Legislator Arla Sturjaluski, founder of the Total Health Clinic in Anchorage, Dr. Richard Newman, and Alaska Native leader Willie Hensley. They all participated in a panel discussion hosted by the UAA Human Services Department on lifelong youthfulness and usefulness. What's age got to do with it? It was recorded at the UAA bookstore on April 5th and edited for broadcast on KSKA. If you would like to hear the full event, including Q&A, you can find a link to the UAA Green and Gold podcast posted along with today's show on alaskapublic.org. Special thanks to UAA for recording the bookstore event. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.